Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Come on. Let's get back to
the
tent. It's all right, Charlie. Right, let's get back to the tent.
Is she okay? Let me help.
Hey, let me put that in front of Charlie.
Hey, yeah, I'll take it. Where are you going? Hey, how did you know? How did you know she was drowning?
I'll tell you how he knew. That guy sees a future, dude.
But we have to go back, brother. It's the Lost Rewatch Podcast here on Pusher Recaps. It's Down the Hatch. I'm Josh Wigler. I'm joined here by Mike Bloom. We're just tripping through time as we are talking about flashes before your eyes. The second ever Desmond Hume flashback episode, the first of season three, Mike. And pretty decisively, just to spoil it, according to the rankings, this is the king of season three so far, by far.
I mean, maybe some slim pickings, maybe some serfs more so than royalty in the court. I mean, Josh, let me come right out of the gate with maybe a scorching take here. I don't know how you feel. Flashes Before Your Eyes upon this rewatch is my favorite episode I've rewatched since Exodus over the course of this podcast.
Oh, since Exodus. I thought that you were going to say just like general.
No, I mean, Exodus is always going to be in my immaculate, untouchable tier. But I think, you know, there are certainly episodes that I've loved. Two for the Road and Lockdown are the two off the top of my head that I would put in that tier right below. But we'll talk about it. Just reinvestigating the storytelling device that frames Flashes Before Your Eyes and just the both thematic and sci-fi elements that are going to become so consequential to not only the character of Desmond, but the series at large. Yeah, it's truly incredible. And we're really watching, you know, a prologue to a much, much longer main book coming up over the next couple of years. But man, I had such a great time going over this episode. I do feel like, you know, a lot of love is given to the Constant, but I can understand why your friend and my Joe Garfine, this is her favorite episode, because yeah. I do think this is one of the, this was the lead up to the plane taking off that runway that was built by Kate and Sawyer, that needed to exist and sort of gets shrugged off in lieu of the sequel, which is much more acclaimed.
Yeah, no, this is, it's an excellent episode of the show. Again, just to spoil it, because what's the point of not? It's, you know, it's going to be a 4.2 for
me. We're jumping forward in time to give our ratings.
Around. Should we just hop around all over the structure of a Down the Hatch episode this week?
I mean, we always do. I feel like every week I say, not to get too far ahead into the ratings of it all. So I feel like I've been living in that time or lack thereof for a while.
Like a staggering amount of 4.2s in the ratings. There's 4.2 from me, from Mike. So that's already going to weight it very heavily. But I'm beyond that counting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 additional 4.2s for this episode. And it's going to give it a 4.16 overall, which is not only going to be lights out the top episode of season three so far, but it is in the conversation for the best episodes of the whole show. I think Exodus is our current front runner at 4.18. And then the pilot is also a 4.16. And Walkabout is a 4.159. So,
wow.
Flash Before Your Eyes is flashing in front of of Walkabout.
Desmond walked in, took out John Locke's legs, and left him sprawling on the ground.
I thought you were going to say, Desmond took off his clothes, and he was flashing us all. But no, this is a crazy episode of the show. It is our first, as the great Ben Behind the Curtain calls it, our first timey-wimey episode. This is our first.
We get real wibbly wobbly in this
one. You know, we're getting into our time travel bullshit here, which I love. I know it's not for everyone. It is incredibly for me. I think that the show does it in such a great way. And I know that there are some questions about, like, how do the Desmond time travel experiences fit alongside the show's otherwise relatively, I would say, like, certainly very elegant time travel rules of whatever happened, happened.
Right, so for those that might not remember, that's what they really develop in season 5, which is all centered around time travel, particularly through the sort of analog of Daniel Faraday is the one to specifically say, hey, we can't change the past to change the future. Fortunately, I think his death maybe sort of stymies that idea, which leads to the incident of it all. But yeah, I mean, he quite literally vocalizes whatever happened, happened. No matter what we do, the same events that played out in the past are going to continue to play out no matter how much we try to meddle in it.
Yeah, but I mean, I think, you know, since we're talking about a time travel episode for the first time, we really ought to spend some time on it. Yeah, the rules are whatever happened, happened. You know, Mike Bloom and I could get zapped back into the 1970s, and we could do some stuff that was very important in the 1970s that would have a great impact on our current lives today in 2020, because that's how it always was. It's not because we're changing a thing. And we could die in the 70s if we got zapped back to the 70s.
We probably would die in the 70s, to be quite honest.
I don't think I'd make it very far.
I've watched Taxi Driver enough.
What would happen? Would you get?
I'm assuming that's what the 70s were like.
Jimmy Fallon and Queen Latifah, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, where, listen, I don't know how I would do in that really rough and tumble taxis of it all, especially living in New York City. So I would not survive a day in that universe.
The smoke monster kind of sounds like a taxi. So yeah, I don't think we would do great. But those are the time travel rules. And then there's the Desmond stuff, where Desmond is supposedly this guy who has a unique relationship with time and space. He has this, whether you want to call it this electromagnetic superpower or even this like electromagnetic anomaly quality to him, and here in Flashes Before Your Eyes, I think on the first blush, you're inclined to think that this is like Desmond zapping back and like changing his past because he knows about the stuff from the island now.
And this is a different type of time travel, though, because usually time travel is like, well, you know, Josh and I don't exist in the 70s, but we're going to go back there and still exist in that timeline, even though we have yet to be born. This is a unique one where almost, you know, like the Quantum Leap, Desmond is zapping back into a version of himself. So it's not like he's appearing in, like, medieval times. So who knows? Maybe if Lost did go on into season 10, that would happen. But this and The Constant are going to be versions of Desmond jumping back to a previous version of Desmond.
I firmly believe that the events of Flashes Before Your Eyes do fall under the whatever happened, happened logic. My feeling is that Desmond's unique relationship with time and space is what allows him to like basically have his consciousness transfer back in time. That we see that happen in The Constant with him, you know, bouncing back and forth between two different time periods where he is having moments in the present and moments in the past. We see that happen to other characters beyond just Desmond, like Minkowski. And he ends up having like a, you know, a very fatal relationship with that anomaly. With Desmond, he doesn't. So I think with Desmond, the uniqueness comes from, you know, however you want to assign it, whether it's because he spent so much time around the electromagnetic energy of the hatch that he was right there and got a face full of the stuff when he turned the key. The fact that if whatever happened always happened, then what happened to him in Flashes Before Your Eyes and all of the events that are happening to him in London must have happened anyway. But I think that it really works. And I think like, the reason why the Desmond of the past is only able to like kind of like half remember things. He got concussed. You know, he got concussed on like two or three different occasions in this episode. He gets concussed when he falls off the ladder. He gets concussed when he gets hit with the cricket bat. He gets probably ruthlessly concussed when he is, you know, part of whatever hatch explosion that's going on. And I think like the Eloise Hawking weirdness that you see in here, I think can be described as very much in line with like the othery tactics that we see, like a lot of those like psychological tactics that are going on there. So I do think that this episode fits with the show's rules of time travel and allows Desmond to sort of be a unique player within that rule set. But I don't think that like what we see in Flashes Before Your Eyes, that like Desmond's changing anything. I think Desmond's life is punctuated by these odd moments, like everything that happens in The Constant, I think is part of his history. I think everything that happens here in Flashes Before Your Eyes is part of his history as well.
Interesting. Yeah, I guess I'm going to have to chew on that a bit. Because, I mean, there are certain things like the picture changing, for instance, that might betray that theory a bit, just because you would argue if that picture got taken in that certain form in the past, it would exist in the present in that regard. So you're saying that this episode, when Desmond has a flashback, it's just him literally having a flashback inside his head, like everybody else of these past moments?
No. I'm definitely saying that his consciousness is being zapped back in time, and all of that is happening, that is actively taking the Desmond who has turned the failsafe key and plugging that guy's consciousness into the body that he is occupying at this moment in time when he has just moved into a flat in London with Penny. But all of that had already happened because he's stuck in this loop.
Previously in 1996, he had had that run in with Eloise. Yes. He broke up with Penny like that. Yes. And he just maybe misremembered things or remembered things slightly different, so that when he got knocked back, despite him trying his best, he was still playing out the same events again.
He's concussed. He half remembers things. He doesn't remember things all the way. There's like, you know, the feelings of cowardice that are really associated with him are being like trotted out as very big, powerful words surrounding these events. I think that there is a lot of like half remembered stuff going on with Desmond here. But yeah, I think it all always happened. And I think that like this loop that Desmond is in here, that he moves on from past this episode, but this loop that always happens where Desmond turns the key and part of him goes back in time and has this relationship with Penny that he severs, that sends him on that course to go to the island and turn the failsafe key. And then he goes back in time and then he severs his relationship with Penny.
Live,
and then
die, repeat.
Yes, exactly. Like, I think that is absolutely what's going on. And I think that does play fully fairly with the whatever happened stuff. It's just that Desmond's experience of that is different than what we see. It's like, you know, his essence, his consciousness, his whatever zapping back into an earlier version of himself is different than what we see with time travel on the show, where people are really like physically moving through time and space.
Yeah, we'll put a pin in that, because I think especially compared to the first Desmond flashback in Live Together, Die Alone, and sort of the circumstance that we get from the Desmond, because I think the smoking gun here is the Desmond-Penny relationship, and how much does that breakup scene inform, you know, the scene at the Tour de Stade that we see in Live Together, Die Alone? How much does that scan? Because if it seems like those two scenes match up, then yeah, it would make sense that Desmond does break up with Penny, and that sort of continues that timeline, like you said. My personal view of time travel is, oddly enough, you know, I'm watching season 2 of The Flash right now on the CW, which deals heavily in time travel. So admittedly, I'm going to spoil a little bit of it for the next couple of minutes. So if for some reason you want to watch that show at some point in time,
yeah,
and you haven't
gotten to The Flash yet, then maybe fast forward like what, like 2 minutes, three minutes?
The Flashes Before Your Eyes of it all. So I personally believe that in a person-specific timeline, there are things known as micro events and macro events, where macro events are big landmark moments. You know, obviously, like the fact that someone's going to die, as we'll see in this episode, or, you know, certain pivotal moments in someone's life that need to exist in order to inform the person that they are. And in between those landmarks, there are micro moments. I would say consider that like the streets you would take to get to a destination, right? Like, you can plug a destination into your GPS, and you can take any number of paths to get there, but no matter what, that GPS is going to take you to that destination. And when we get to this idea of the path that Eloise is going to talk about later on in this episode, my personal belief is that Desmond did go back and was able to subtly change things, whether it was, you know, him getting hit with the cricket bat or the photo being, you know, slightly different. It just wasn't able to have a major effect on these major facets of his life. As was said in 11-22-63, the past is obdurate. Daniel Faraday sort of refers to it there too, with whatever happened, happened, that again, there are these macro events that almost serve as magnets in their own regard that you're going to be drawn to no matter what you do. It's inevitability. And the reason I bring up the Flash is because, you know, that also brings up a question of, wait a minute, if you go back and travel in time, like, doesn't that send you onto another timeline? And how does that affect the present that we're seeing? There's an episode of The Flash where Barry Allen goes back in time about a year to the events of season one. And he makes sure to still have the macro events, you know, take place, basically the events at the end of season one, and make sure it's not to impede in the timeline a lot. That being said, he still impedes in the timeline, to the point where there is a character, Harley Rathaway, who I believe is a Pied Piper, is his evil villain name, and he was a big villain in season one, and through the events of Barry going back in time, he comes back to the present, and everything is pretty much the same, except Harley Rathaway is now a good guy and on their side because of what Barry Allen did that day. And that to me is an example of, like, if you change a micro event, you stay on that same timeline. You're not going to come back and everyone's going to have donuts for heads or three hands or something because of you know, the fly that you swatted back then. But if he had changed something hugely significant, that could send things off in a particularly different direction. Possibly, you know, ending things, ending the world, or putting someone on a path where they end up causing the end of the world, as Eloise is talking about. So I definitely, I guess it's a sort of like a partial warping of your theory, but it's something that I've definitely been chewing over the past few weeks since I watched that episode, that I agree that I think Desmond's traveling back in time here, but I personally think that he was able to make these changes. It's just that the lesson is, like, whatever happened, happened, with an asterisk, and the asterisk is, like, well, the major plot points are still going to have to be hit no matter what, but there are certain details that you could change that really have no effect on how things play out the rest of the time.
What's the subtle difference in the photo that you're talking about?
I'm trying to remember. I'm pretty sure she doesn't have her head resting on his shoulder the first time we see the picture. I'm going to pull it up right now.
I feel like maybe we've gone over this, or maybe I'm having, like, one of those Mandela effect moments of remembering something that we haven't actually talked about, but remembering that, like, they just had to, like, redo the photo, basically, that they had to redo the Desmond and Penny photo to, like, make it fit more in continuity. So I have not really considered that as, like, butterfly effect type stuff. I've just always considered that the photo that's taken in Flashes Before Your Eyes that we see in multiple other points throughout Lost is the photo. And that's the one. That's the photo that we see. That is the, you know, the Desmond and Penny photo takes place during the breakup.
Well, to the point where, actually, I believe wasn't the first time we saw the Desmond and Penny photo, like, it was the wrong person when we saw it in the beginning of season two. So, yeah, this photo has had a day. But, yeah, actually, I'm looking at a picture at Pinterest.com that compares the two photos. The top is the shot from Flashes Before Your Eyes, and the bottom is the picture outright. And, yeah, you could see there's subtle differences, like Penny is more leaned into Desmond's neck, Desmond's wearing a different shirt, Desmond's hair is different, Desmond's giving a different smile. So, I mean, you could take it as just a production difference, or we could just take it as the official picture taken in this is canon, and we don't need to worry about any sort of minor differences in the timeline.
I think that the fun thing about Desmond as a character, though, is that he's an avatar. And I think one of the reasons why he's so beloved is he's an avatar for, like, these types of debates that you could still have around Lost, where, like, you could see it your way or you could see it another way. And it would be, you know, you'd be arguing for a long time and, like, circling the drain of how did this all work for a long time without getting any real resolution. But, like, in a way that is really fun to do, like, in a way that isn't, like, maddening, at least not for me, like, in a way that's, like, very pleasurable and satisfying. And I think that the fact that, like, Desmond is a character who either, like, defies the rules or transcends the rules, or at least has an unusual relationship to the rules, I think is a big piece of what makes him a really, really fun player on the board.
Well, the thing is, one of the reasons why I love this episode too, is that this is a rule-breaking episode in so many ways. You know, a lot of praise gets lauded onto Through the Looking Glass with what it does with its flashbacks, but I'm going to beat the drum again and say that Flashes Before Your Eyes kind of did it first in unconventional storytelling. Maybe it doesn't help that it's sort of just like sandwiched in the middle here in the first third of season three, but I cannot say enough how impressed I was by this episode because, man, we talk all the time about Darlton taking swings. They took a huge swing here.
Big swing.
Save for 10 minutes at the beginning and 3 minutes at the end, the entire episode takes place within this weird time travel-y flashback structure. And it nails it. And it really introduces, you know, characters we really don't know about. We really don't know much about Desmond, despite having a flashback episode about him. And now we're really introduced to him, but in a completely different view where, to your point, he is sort of this analog going through this with us, like, holy crap, I jump back in time, I think. Let me see what happens. Introducing a bunch more characters, pumping up other characters like Charles Widmore. There is a lot on this plate, but it is a delicious, delicious dish.
I like eating the dish. Big fan of the dish. Let's dive in. We begin with a shot of Desmond, but really the main action does begin with Charlie and Hurley ransacking Sawyer's tent, having a little bit of a debate over whether or not this is ethical.
Yeah, it's interesting. This episode, with the, you know, the quote-unquote main three gone in Kate, Sawyer, and Jack, it's interesting to see that Desmond, especially immediately with saving Claire, is going to take on some Jack-like tendencies. And Charlie's going to be a kind of like a squirrely Sawyer here, right? Where like he is sort of taking on the lawlessness, altruistic, or not non-altruistic of like, hey, you know what? He did it to us first and he's still hoarding stuff. I guess this also answers the question of like, post the long con slash Sawyer getting his pants pulled down by Jack in the poker game, like what really happened to the stash outside of the guns of it all? I guess Sawyer still sort of hung on to it. Maybe everyone was so distracted by the palette drop, but it looks like season one Sawyer was still around a bit in that he was hoarding a bunch of stuff, including a bunch of nudie mags.
Nudie magazine day. And there's also some more of those cookies and cream sandwiches.
Oh, God. So. I'm surprised he didn't tear through them. Considering maybe he put all the sandy cookies back into the bag for a rainy day.
Desmond comes and fetches Charlie and Hurley to bring them to the jungle, where John Locke, without any delicateness at all, just delivers the news. Echo is dead.
At least in this case, Nikki and Paolo have finally been dismissed from their very, very awkward place in the Echo funeral group. They got like promptly sent to the bench, as it were, to probably go have sex in Jack's tent again.
Yeah, I mean, they're really not going to have much to do again until they die. I'm really trying to think of like how many episodes are they even in before Exposé at this point?
I'm trying to think. Yeah, because, you know, maybe it was the fact that through that 3 month hiatus, they basically heard the thumbs down across the world.
Well,
they say
that they felt it in the writer's room, like they felt it in the writing that this was not working, that this was not, a series of characters that were working out for them. And they knew that they couldn't just like write them off and not explain where they went, that they actually like would have to go as far as effectively like crafting an episode to outright apologize for their existence. So we are going to see Nikki next. So we haven't seen her since I Do.
Right.
She's not in Portland. She's not in Flashes Before Your Eyes. She's not going to be in next week in Stranger in a Strange Land. So that's one merit in Stranger in a Strange Land's favor. She will be in Trisha Tanaka is Dead.
Because I believe it looks like basically Paolo is going to be once again poo-poo Paolo again and turn down the Dharma Van thing. And Nikki's going to once again show enthusiasm for it.
Yeah, and she'll be in Enter 7-7 as well, and then it's Exposé. So we're, you know, you remember Nikki and Paolo as being like these obscenely awful characters, and it's really just that they're in a decent amount of that batch of like first six episodes of Island stuff, and the fact that I think that they are present for the Mr. Echo demise and funeral is like, you two don't deserve to be here. And I think that that's where a lot of the ire comes from, because other than that, they're in a few scenes. They suck, but they're not like massively all over Lost.
Well, and I think it also makes sense given their absence here, because Locke essentially got Desmond to bring Hurley and Charlie here because they're essentially like going to serve as the React bros for the Gawkers at large, where Locke, you know, as you said, puts it very bluntly, Echo's dead, the island killed him. I love Charlie's indignant response of, what do you mean the island killed him? Spoiler alert, I don't think this is actually a great Charlie episode, but I do like his reaction here. But Locke basically says, like, hey, the only reason why you guys know is because everyone's going to be freaking out, and you guys are, you know, basically going to be the emotional moral compass and help calm everybody down in that case.
Yeah, you're going to have to keep everybody calm, but calm is hard to come by considering the fact that Desmond's getting twitchy. Desmond's starting to tweak out, and Hurley, who's already suspecting Desmond of harboring secret superpowers, is going to be watching him like a hawk, like a hurly bird. And Desmond is going to take off like a bat out of hell because he's hearing something in the jungle. And one of the things that I really love about Henry Ian Cusack as Desmond is how when he runs, he often just flails like a Muppet. Yeah. He's flailing in full Kermit the Frog mode.
Desmond, essentially, like, you know, it's sad that in the end we see Desmond and Vincent on the screen at the same time, because Desmond is a dog in
kind of
so
is.
Many ways. Like, between his running, his loyalty, his sort of like single track mind with certain things, like, he really does have a dog like behavior. And I think that's why he is also such a beloved character, in part, is because his characteristics are just like so lovable in that regard.
Very good boy, right? As Desmond's he's running out so that he can save Claire, who is, you know, about to drown in the ocean. But he's not there specifically to save Claire. He's there specifically to save Charlie, which just leads you to wonder that if Desmond didn't intercede, who was going to save Claire? Or does he not just really care about Claire?
Yeah, or I guess that means, like, you know, Charlie, maybe he was wise then to try to not save Joanna back in season one, because maybe he would have drowned then too.
He,
you know, we'll get
there.
Charlie's swimming prowess later on, but I guess when it comes to lifeguarding, Charlie's doesn't have all that.
Yeah, but Charlie's going to be very like, how did you know? How did you know she was drowning? And Hurley has the great line of, I'll tell you how he knew. How he knew. That guy, he sees the future, dude.
I also love, there's a lot of awkwardness going on, which in retrospect, you understand, right? Like, Desmond doesn't even want Charlie to touch Claire, and it's not because of the John Locke, like, territorial aspect that Charlie's going to think. It's more so like, I don't want to jinx you, man. I'm trying to help you out here, and who knows,
dude.
Maybe a sea urchin jumps onto you and stings you, and you die as a result. But Charlie is so trying to get involved that there's this really, like, awkward shot of, you know, Desmond carrying Claire, fireman style, onto the beach, and Charlie's, like, awkwardly holding onto her foot to be like, I've got this too, I'm helping as well. It's a little remnant of season two Charlie, and you do feel for him a bit, because he really cares for Claire, and he has no idea what's going on here, but I did feel for Charlie a bit with just him trying to awkwardly pitch in on Desmond's single-handed job here.
Yeah, for sure. He's trying to be involved. So Desmond sees the future. Desmond and Claire are going to have a quick conversation where Claire is, like, seemingly doing, like, a lot better, really pretty much immediately after that whole thing. Desmond is staring at his picture of Penny. Claire's thinking about the picture of Penny. Claire's asking about Penny, and Desmond, you know, talks about, this is Penelope, she's Penny, and Charlie shows up. He's very mad that Claire has been gone for longer than 5 minutes. It's back to being, like, kind of indignant
Charlie.
Yeah, I told
you, season two Charlie comes back a bit in this episode.
Little bit. Charlie and Hurley are going to go for a little bit of a walk, and Hurley's, like, trying to convince Charlie that, yeah, Desmond sees the future, man. That guy can predict the future. Charlie says if he could see the future, that he wouldn't have come here, which is a decent point.
Yeah, I mean, I think he sees future as, like, he sees every single thing that's going to happen always, rather than what we're going to find out about Desmond, which is literal flashes of things that may even happen. So it's not necessarily he has a history book that's able to show what happens when. It's more so random happenstance things pop up that might happen as soon as, like, 30 seconds from now and as long as, like, maybe 2 weeks from now.
Hurley and Charlie are going to go to Desmond. They've got a plan. They're going to get him wasted. They're going to booze him up and pry the truth out of him that way, because they've seen him stone cold drunk before. That's how he showed up in everybody's lives. So, like, this guy loves to drink. We've got Sawyer's stash. We're going to hook him up. And Desmond at first is like, come on, guys. It's not a thing we need to do. You really don't need to thank me.
Do you not remember when I was just, like, laid out suicidal, housing all this wine, like, 2 weeks ago? I'm good. I'm
fine.
I'm sobering up now.
I've had my fill, but then he sees what the drink is. It's McCutcheon. And Desmond starts laughing like a crazy person.
Were we assuming McCutcheon came from? So I guess, was this from the hash? Did this happen to be on the plane in like the first class ritzy drink cart that Sawyer? No, because the airplane bottles were the ones that Sawyer was using. Where did the McCutcheon come from? Because as Charles Widmore is going to talk about, it's quite a hoity piece of alcohol there.
Well, if Charles Widmore spent so much time on the island, it's not impossible that he had his own secret stash of McCutcheon somewhere, and Vincent, much like he sniffed out the heroin-packed Virgin Marys, maybe he sniffed out the stash of McCutcheon-packed Virgin Mary statues that Charles Widmore had hidden somewhere.
Ooh, I love
that. And he brought them to Sawyer.
You know what? Maybe it was the Black Rock. They're like, well, crashed plane is drugs, yeah. Crashed boat is alcohol.
Yeah, dynamite and booze.
Right, it makes sense. It's like also like a very much nautical theme, sort of like the darker liquors with
Admiral
it.
McCutcheon, right? You know, yeah. he was aboard the Black Rock. That's right.
Yeah, so Widmore technically could have led them to the Black Rock if he was there instead of Danielle Rousseau. He knows it very well. That's where I stole my hooch.
Yeah, that's where he drinks and he sings Girls with One Leg. And all of that good stuff.
You know that hit song, Girls with One Leg.
Drive Shaft's going to cover it. Desmond cracks up when he sees the McCutcheon, and Charlie's like going to offer him a glass, and he doesn't want the glass. If you came here to drink, let's drink. He just wants the bottle. And I timed this, Mike. He's chugging a bottle of McCutcheon whiskey for a hard 5 seconds.
Yeah, and we're not talking, you know, fake, like, glug, 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 like, Henry Ian Cusack is also, I always admire the chugging ability when actors, whether it be, you know, John Belushi in Animal House or Tina Fey eating an entire sandwich in 30 Rock, but him committing to chugging this whiskey for 5 seconds straight is an art in its own way.
I mean, there's zero chance it's not real whiskey,
but I just say in general, like, drinking or eating things in excess on camera, I do feel like takes a lot of commitment.
Yeah, I hope it wasn't too many takes that he had to do, but he's like straight up chugging a whiskey bottle filled with like apple juice.
Yeah, so what do you think that is? Do you think it's a matter of him being like, well, I finally get this opportunity to drink something that's been deprived of me for so long?
Yeah.
Is this more symbolic to him of like, I got my honor back,
both.
Charles Widmore, screw you?
Both, or probably also like the recency of the flashes before your eyes events are very fresh on his mind, so McCutcheon is like incredibly fresh on his mind at the moment.
Yeah, I guess that's true as well of like, oh, this is interesting. And maybe that was also a sign to him of like everything is connected, right? And that him coming to the island did mean that it was all worth it.
Yeah. So as these things often go, Mike, the drinking starts out very fun and then it plummets. Let's listen in sound number one.
She swore like a ducker with a cracking set of knockers. She was only the farmer's daughter.
Lizzie.
Cheers.
Hey, the only song's about drinking and fighting and girls with one leg.
Wow. Girls with one leg and a heart of gold.
So, Desi,
let me ask you something.
Anything, pal.
How'd you know Claire was drowning?
I could hear her calling for help.
Oh, no, you didn't. You're like a mile away.
Well, I suppose then. I've got good hearing.
You, hear the lightning as well.
Excuse me?
The lightning. Just by chance, you pitch your little rod outside Claire's tent. 2 hours later, lightning strikes.
Thanks for the drink, pal.
Hey, I don't know what you're doing. You best tell us. Oi! You think because you turned some key that makes you a hero? No hero, brother. I don't know how you're doing what it is you're doing, but I know a coward when I see one.
You don't want to know what happened to me. You don't want to know.
Yeah, Charlie.
Great scene. I mean, very funny. The singing, and like I imagine, like Hurley, like this is some measure of culture shock that's happening for him as Desmond and Charlie both are just like connecting over their shared experiences in the UK.
Yeah, because we haven't really had that before, right? We had like sort of like non-American British territories bonding in Charlie and Claire with the UK and Australia, but this is the first time we have, you know, Charlie interacting with another character from the UK that's not his brother.
Yeah, this is really fun. Really, really fun. And especially because these two characters are going to be so linked this season, that to get them really connecting at the start of this scene is super, super fun. But yeah, then Charlie has the unmitigated gall to call anyone a coward after some of the things that he has done.
Yeah, and you can tell he's purposely poking the bear, right? And I don't think he did it in a way that, like, he thought he was going to get choked. They were going to choke the Charlie after that. But I think that he certainly was, like, I think he knew that, and maybe this was also speaking to his own inebriation as well, which I do wonder how much that plays into, like, his own sobriety of it all. I know drugs and alcohol are not exactly comparable. So I admit that I think the start of this scene especially is fun. I will admit, if there's one sort of weakness for me in Flashes Before Your Eyes, it's that it does take us two acts to get into really the meat of the episode. Not to say that it's not entertaining what we experience in those first 11 minutes, but I do wonder if there's an episode that exists that maybe takes out even half or maybe the entire fire scene and just like takes us in some way, maybe have Claire drowning and then do the Desmond flashback in, and then have that play out for the rest of the episode. Cause as we'll talk about, I think the wraparound is a little weird before the You're Gonna Die Charlie stuff. But I was just loving so much the stuff that happens with the time flash that I was like, I wish we had even more time dedicated to it in the episode.
Yeah. I don't want to live in that world because I love that when Lost is joyful is one of my favorite things. And there's so much joy in this scene before it goes dark. but like, I really love that stuff, especially because Charlie's been such a dump of a character for so long that like just like to get like some of that like just like very naturally charismatic, charming Dominic Monaghan energy is fun for me. It does take the turn, but you know the stuff leading up to that I think is just it's really 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 fun. And also Jorge Garcia plays it really well too, of him just like kind of being like sprawled out on the sand. That feels very real. Like that feels like moments that I've had too.
It's happy to see happy inebriated Charlie, yes. Right? Because we've seen a lot of dark inebriated Charlie. We've seen addict Charlie. We've never seen Hurley inebriated before, and now we see happy inebriated Desmond. So it's a cool way, because I feel like usually when we're talking about like people getting drunk or holding drinking sessions, it's usually Sawyer, right? The last major one, I think, was the I Never game in Outlaws. So it's nice to have this be a bit of a sequel, even though, like you said, this one turns a bit more violent and physical in a different way than Sawyer wanted it to be back in Outlaws.
So Desmond bum rushes Charlie and he starts, you know, you don't want to know what
your
happened
to
me.
Your ass just got sacked.
Yeah. G.I. Joe. So Desmond has sacked Charlie.
That would be Royal Army Des.
Yes, exactly. So we start getting the flashes. And so this is a flashback technically, right? Like, because like, the flashes aren't happening right this second.
Right. I mean, it technically cuts to the end of Live Together, Die Alone with the events of the Hatchet Bunny, which I am so glad, unlike maternity leave, super subtle segue into it, which shows you don't need jarring noises to show us that it's a flashback show.
Yeah, so we're flashing back to the end of Live Together, Die Alone. He's turned the hatch, is going haywire. I love you, Penny. He turns the key, and now we are in the past. We are several years earlier, and Desmond is waking up on the ground, covered in blood. Just kidding, it's paint.
Yeah, and they're wearing their own personal painter's uniform, which is oddly similar to the one from the hatch. You know, there is a lot of red in this episode, Josh, and I did a bit of color theory for this episode because red was so prevalent. So from colormatters.com, red is the color of extremes. It's the color of passionate love, seduction, violence, danger, anger, and adventure. Our prehistoric ancestors saw red as the color of fire and blood, energy and primal life forces, and most of red's symbolism today arises from its powerful associations in the past. Red is also a magical and religious color. It symbolized superhuman heroism to the Greeks and is the color of the Christian crucifixion. Red was almost as rare and as expensive as purple in ancient days, a fact that may explain its magic and power. So, I mean, that was a loaded description, but I feel like red as a color hits so many themes in this episode. I mean, even just reading off passionate love, seduction, violence, danger, anger, and adventure all happen in this episode.
Yeah.
The idea that red represents something supernatural and religious in this episode, and the fact that red was a color that was like very rare and very expensive. Look at McCutcheon as an example as well. Like, I love the use of the color in this episode, because in a show that associates it so much around the black and white and everything in between, to have this pop of color not only made for a great fake out initially, but also just really ties into a lot of stuff that gets brought into this episode.
Yeah, I love that. And I think speaks to the uniqueness of Desmond. It's funny because he's going to say in this episode, I don't even like the color red. He hates the color red, but he's going to be wearing a red shirt for his, you know, the vast majority of his time on the show at the end, in the final season, which I always thought was like a strange borderline bad color choice for the character. Mm-hmm. I like this interpretation of that. I think it's fun. And to like think of him as this, you know, bloody red X factor, like this beating heart X factor, in this battle between light and shadow, I think is a fun interpretation. But he's, yeah, you know, wiped out on the ground.
And I will also say, we know that Desmond's favorite color is green, don't we?
Yeah.
Yes, we do.
he loves the color green. He also loves donkeys. Shrekman. Oh gosh. But he's covered in not blood. Penny comes in. She says, this is the result of climbing ladders, painting ceilings, and alcohol. Desmond with one leg and a heart of gold. She's asking what's wrong with him. And he's having like this very strange look about him that suggests that he is having deja vu.
Mm-hmm.
And it must be that feeling of waking up from a very vivid dream is what he's had, because he is here. He is very much actually here in this moment. Even though half a second earlier, he was being bathed in a big white light before, winding up here covered in red paint.
Yeah,
so
and for
the
all
time
he knows,
travel has begun.
Well, I mean, there's so many things that could happen. Like, was that all a dream? Was this just me concussed on the ground and dreaming like 3 years of my life? Is this heaven? Did I die? Because I'm assuming that's the intention behind which he turned the failsafe key. Hence the I love you, Penny, and his final words to Locke. And this is what the afterlife is. This is his good place, in a way. Like, Desmond is tripping right now, understandably so. And Henry and Cusack does such a great job of, like, realizing that, but also, like, trying to play it off as well. Like, he's very much straddling this line of, like, don't freak out too much, just play the game right now and we'll figure out the rules later. Especially initially when he just gives like this completely slack-jawed, wide-eyed hug to Penny, who was someone that he never thought he would see again.
So in my interpretation of events, he's waking up here. It's years earlier from the moment that he's turned the failsafe key. It's 1996. He's turned the failsafe key in 2004 and is waking up in 1996. And this is how it's always happened. That in 1996, he wiped out on the ladder, knocked his head on the ground, and woke up with the consciousness of the man who's been through this before. And that all of the things that he's going to see here in flashes before your eyes and all the things that's happened here are things that have happened to him before again and again and again ad nauseum. That is my interpretation. I wonder if there's room for interpretation of Desmond being in any kind of like flash sideways scenario.
Yeah,
right.
So
now?
So let me bring this up, because the Ben Behind the Curtain actually kind of brought up a theory here. So what if this isn't actually a flashback? What if this is a mind F from Smokey that either the island or the man in black sort of like put Desmond in this weird sort of, you say flash sideways, maybe like holodeck is more the thing I would think of, where he's now in this situation and is sort of like basically being given the reason why, like, he is important and why he needs to continue to either carry out Jacob's mission or mm-hmm. work against it, depending on your interpretation, that he actually did not go back in time here, that he is just playing out a scenario that makes him believe he traveled back in time as a test, which we talk about a lot with Locke, as to either his commitment to the island or against the island.
Yeah, so, I don't know, food for thought. I think, like, whatever your flash is before your eyes canon is your flash is before your eyes canon. Like, I'm good with just about, you know, any interpretation you want to take away from this one. I think Desmond and the things that Desmond represents are among the most personal and subjective experiences one can have with Lost. So just wanted to put that out there just as a possibility. I'd never really thought about it before. I don't really subscribe to it, but I think it's interesting to at least chew on a little bit.
Yeah, well, especially in the wake of all this Echo stuff that we were talking about, right? Of, like, the test that Jacob and the Man in Black were putting on these other characters. I don't think it's exactly outside the ballpark that they would do maybe a similar thing to this very odd character who finds himself in a unique situation.
Totally. All right. So he and Penny are going to kiss. He's like, all right, everything's coming up. Everything's coming up, Milhouse. Everything's coming up, Milhouse. Yeah. So he's doing great. He's going to be prepping for a job interview. It's 1:08 p.m. Mm-hmm. Unless it's 1:08 in the morning, but that seems
it's
hard.
It's a real early interview. Your dad's a hard ass.
1:08 p.m. is a pretty late interview, I feel like.
I mean, listen, I'm assuming Winmore maybe has a busy morning, and so he, maybe, like, clears some time in his afternoon.
Maybe. Anyway, he's going to start getting ready. Why don't we listen in on his prep?
Here. Let me.
Thanks.
Oh, hang on. You've got paint on your neck.
Huh?
How's that concussion?
Oh, my severe head injury is a small price to pay for the pleasure of having you move into my humble... Is Rat Trap accurate?
Mm-mm. Voila. You know you don't really need a job from my father, Des.
It's not about the job. I want him to respect me.
And respect you he shall. But if for some reason he's too daft to see how brilliant you are, it's not the end of the world.
What did you say?
Here you go, love. You all right?
Yeah, I'm fine. Just had a bit of a deja vu, that's all.
Who knew that Penny had Down the Hatch on the background and was listening to the intro when Desmond was putting on his tie?
Yeah, that's Alex G. He did a really great theme song for the podcast.
Exactly. I mean, maybe that's what a 2020 Lost would, instead of putting Sarah McLachlan's Building a Mystery on, which right on the nose there with that song choice, instead it would be like a podcast while they're getting ready, right?
I like it. I think that would be good. A couple of things to note. Rat Trap, not only a great Transformers from the Beast Wars and Beast Machine days.
Oh, that takes me back. Beast Wars, Transformers.
You know, not only a great character, Rat Trap from those shows.
I remember getting the toy of Rat Trap and just being so, I don't know, like, angry just because he was, like, such a little twerp that I'm like,
yeah,
no!
It's better character than he was an action figure,
yeah,
I would
exactly.
say. We'll talk about that
more. Nobody aspires to have Rat Trap in their home.
We'll do more of that when we get into our Down the Hatch Transformers Beast Wars follow up at some point.
Yeah, that's a natural segue.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Well, the Transformers, they're, you know, in Beast Wars, they're stranded as well. They're far away from Cybertron.
And there are animals involved, just like pulling things
involved.
They transform like the smoke monster does.
Mm-hmm. There's time travel. They're traveling back in time to prehistoric Earth.
There's bad CGI like we see sometimes
in
Lost.
There, listen, don't come after Beast Wars, man. There's brutal deaths on Beast Wars. They're very emotional, character-centric episodes. Beast Wars was the shit. Anyway, Rat Trap, because Faraday is going to be doing like the little mice mazes with his time travel shenanigans.
He's going to meet the namesake of the rat later on that afternoon.
Yes, that's correct. There's also going to be, you have a little bit of paint on your neck, which I think is an interesting thing that I hadn't picked up on before, and I'm sure it's not intentional, but it's just one of those things where it's like the ripples of Lost are so fun to examine. And here's one where Desmond, in this moment where he's like in this surreality, right? Like, this is not, he's not in Kansas anymore. He's got like what looks to be like a slash on his neck. And one of the first things we'll see from Jack in the flash sideways is examining a slash that he has on his neck, which, you know, he thinks is like a cut from shaving or whatever, but is actually from his death experience. So I just like the way that those two things connect.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing that, again, connects to like someone waking up in a different timeline than what they're used to. Another reason why I pulled this clip is because, again, you know, Live Together, Die Alone, we got a sense as to who Desmond and Penny were at that point in their relationship, which was to say their non-existent relationship. We were in the when you get married, Pen, stage of everything that I really wanted to showcase how they were as a couple before the breakup later on this episode. And they're just as squee-worthy as you might think. They get along.
Squee!
Yeah, they get along super well. But it is interesting. I think it's a bit symbolic that Penny is the one who has to tie Desmond's tie for him, that he struggles with it. It definitely, sort of like we talked about with Sun and Jin, and we'll get shades of Paik here with Whitmore coming up. It symbolizes a man that is out of his element, but will do what it takes for love. And that's going to inform so much of what Jin does and so much of what Desmond does in very different ways, but it's a very similar thematic connection.
I think one of the reasons why Desmond is such a resonant character is because he embodies a lot of different traits from a lot of the different characters that we love. Within Desmond, there is the Jin and Sun love story, right? Like, Jin and Sun walk so Desmond and Penny can run for a lot of people.
And Desmond can run.
And he can run. And so, like, through Desmond, there is sort of this leading man quality that exists within Jack. With Desmond, there is this guy who can just, like, who can, like, throw down in a fight and drink super hard, much like Sawyer. Knows his way around electronics, much like Saeed. You know, I from the UK, much like Charlie. Mystical in his relationship with the island, much like John Locke. I think Desmond, a lot of the threads of Lost travel through him. And I think that that is a big piece of why this character is one of the most popular characters on the show, because basically the main things, or like a lot of the big piece things that you love about all of these other characters on the show, are also present in Desmond. Desmond is like your classic utility player.
Right.
You can plug him into so many different roles and he would excel in just about all of them.
Yeah, he really is sort of like the Renaissance man in that regard, in that he possesses so many different qualities of the characters that we love.
He can be funny, he can be heartbreaking, he can be a badass. Yeah. Like he's got everything. You know, like Desmond really is just the full package.
Yeah, I mean, he is the package.
He's
later
literally
on.
The package. Yeah,
but he is sort of like the, I don't know. It's tough, also tough to find like negative qualities in him, as opposed to some of the other characters. You know, Jack's reticence to fix something, John Locke's stubbornness when he believes in something, Sawyer being an a-hole. Like, there are relatable yet apparent faults within them. And outside of, you know, maybe the way that Desmond handles the breakup and being withholding with the information, I don't know. I'm sure I'm opening myself up to something,
very,
but like, he's...
I think that's very Jack. You know, I think that that's a lot of like the Jack quality. That's like very, very stubborn. And I think there's a good amount of like Jin in there too. Very proud.
He has to get his honor back.
Yeah, I think that there is a lot of that stuff still in Desmond. And I think that that's important too. That, you know, a big part of the reason why we love any of these characters on this show is because they're flawed, like the game. And so is Desmond. You know, Desmond's flaws are, I think, obscured by his strengths, as they should be. And as is hopefully the case for the most successful characters on the show. And by successful, I mean their resonance with the viewer. But I just think that because Desmond also possesses so many of the strengths that these other characters have, it just makes him sort of this transcendent character where he's a really agreeable person to like point to and be like, that's the best character on the show, mm-hmm. because he's just got so many of the qualities that make these other characters so great.
Yeah, absolutely. Though, I mean, if you ask the man that he's about to talk to, he possesses none of them.
Yeah, all right. So let's go to the job interview. There's
and we'll say at the top here, just to, we'll yada yada through like the package number for 8:15. But I will say the receptionist says one of my least favorite often said lines in pop culture history. And you are.
I
hate that line with a seething passion because it's nobody ever says it in real life. It's hoity AF. It sounds stupid. It's so presumptive. Like, it has the perfect Venn diagram of being both unnatural and just very negative.
Yeah. So there's that. There's a parcel for room 815 or whatever. Okay, that's fun. It's all happening. Charles Widmore's office has a polar bear in it. Knowing what we know about Charles Widmore, that he is a guy who hails from the island, was an other, was like the leader of the others for a long time, is trying really hard to go back, much like Jack. Is it impossible that this painting that's in his office is like literally commissioned? To like bring back memories of the island?
Perhaps. I know we also have some of Thomas's paintings are in here as well. And again, you might say, like, I know Damon himself said it's coincidental because that just comes from the art team. But who knows? Maybe Widmore has his fingers in so many different pies that he's like, oh, I heard about, you know, I heard about Claire Littleton's deadbeat boyfriend having these pictures. I'd like to buy them just to hold one over on him, even though he has no idea who I am.
I have a question. Does this mean that we can throw an LVP point on Thomas because appears in this episode?
He does make a cameo appearance here, but you know what? I think we have to avoid it for now because there are people much more deserving of LVP points as we're about to talk about right now.
There's a couple of other candidates. Yeah, so not in the Jacob sense. So Desmond is a candidate for a job here. He's admiring the room. He's admiring that little boat. And he's like, oh, yeah, it's for the solar race around the world that you're going to be on. I mean, I can't talk about that. And so Charles Widmore is going to hire Desmond, but it's not the real reason Desmond is here. Desmond's going to reveal the real reason why he's here. And it's going to, once again, seems like it's going well. And then once again, a booze-fueled reveal that things are not so great. Let's listen to it.
Well, Desmond, I'm going to see to it that you have a position in our administrative department. Not the most glamorous duty, but it's a start. I'll speak to human resources.
With all due respect, sir, I haven't come here to interview for a position in your company.
You haven't?
No, sir. I came here to ask for your daughter's hand in marriage. We've been together 2 years now, and Penn's moving in, and I love her. But your permission would mean everything to me.
I'm impressed, Hume. Very noble gesture. You know anything about whiskey?
No, I'm afraid not, sir.
This is a 60-year McCutcheon, named after Anderson McCutcheon, esteemed admiral from the Royal Navy. He retired with more medals than any man before or since. Moved to the Highlands to see out his remaining years. Admiral McCutcheon was a great man, Hume. This was his crowning achievement. This swallow is worth more than you could make in a month. And to share it with you would be a waste and a disgrace to the great man who made it. Because you, Hume, will never be a great man.
Widmore. I know I'm not.
What you're not is worthy of drinking my whiskey. How could you ever be worthy of my daughter?
My whiskey. So Charles Widmore's a dick.
Yeah.
Let's put that out there. Charles Widmore's awful. Charles Widmore will get LVP points this week. They will be deserved.
Yes, one of many, many weeks. Again, we got a teeny bit of Chucky Woods in that one scene in Live Together, Die Alone.
Get in the car.
Yeah, but that was just the tip of the iceberg that's floating in a glass of whiskey as we really, I think, get to the heart of this character and why he is such a flagrant asshole.
Sure. But do we want to consider the universe in which Charles Widmore, in this moment in time, knows that Desmond David Hume is going to go to the island, is not going to the island so that he can get Desmond away from Penny, but is going to the island because whatever happened, happened, and he knows that that guy at some point in the future has to go to the hatch and push that button and turn that failsafe key? Is it possible that both the actions of Charles Widmore and Eloise Hawking in this episode are specifically designed to be antagonistic, to push Desmond towards this very important fate that he needs to accomplish in order to make sure that the world doesn't explode?
If that's the case, way too convoluted for him. We've actually talked about this a bit during Live Together, Die Alone, because we were asked about this. I think if that was the case, this would be a complicated plan that even Sawyer would look at and be like, damn, y'all got too many steps in there. Because that would have to be like, all right, I have to anger Desmond enough that he will purposely break things off with Penny and then take my sailing race around the world in this particular year so that he winds up in this particular section of the sea to wash ashore on the island. Look, is Charles Widmore beyond putting together multifaceted, complicated plans? No. Is it necessary? No. I think.
But what you sketched out is such an others thing to do. That's like it's like lining up a bus driver to wait until Edmund is about to cross the street so you can plow
him
down.
That's one step, though. But it
is a complicated step.
It's a complicated
that stems from like a throwaway line.
But then like also, but we're talking multiple years. Desmond's going to wash up on that island in 2001. Mm-hmm. This is 1996. Charles Widmore would have to make a 5-year plan to plant a seed in Desmond, who's ironically enough probably trying to plant a seed in his daughter, to break up that relationship so he gets irate enough to prove himself to Widmore in that particular time in 2001 to take the boat to the island at that particular time frame.
Yeah, all that would take is a time-traveling Eloise Hawking who witnesses this stuff happening, knows that this stuff is going to happen, is spurred on into this action by knowing that she's going to kill her son, gets heavily invested in trying to see if she can fix that scenario, begins to understand, no, she cannot fix that scenario. She's going to have to raise her son to die. That's a thing that she is going to have to do in order to preserve the timeline and preserve history. And talk to versions of herself, talk to Charles Widmore, and be like, yo, Desmond's got to go to the island. That dude cannot be with Penny. He's got to be on this path. If he's ever coming towards you and is looking for a happy ending, just be a dick. Just push him away. Just push that guy away. Keep him as far away from Penny as possible. Like, all of that, I think, plays totally fine and fair within the rules of time travel. I don't want to absolve Charles Widmore of being a dick. That dude is a dick. This is really mean. He is being really, really cruel and terrible here. But I think that when you contrast this also with like the way that he engages with Desmond in the final season of the show, like he is now starting to like communicate with Desmond with a level of like, I don't need to like, you know, tiptoe around any of this stuff anymore. Like, you're very important and we really need you. Like, I think that that's just a possibility that's in play. I think that there's an interpretation of this where Widmore doesn't want Desmond involved with his daughter, probably because he knows that he's super dangerous and that means danger for Penny, but also because he knows that Desmond actually is kind of a big deal.
Or I think he just hates Desmond.
It's also possible. Totally.
I think Desmond is classist AF. I mean, if that's the case, I'm going to give more kudos to Eloise Hawking than Charles Widmore, because Charles Widmore's approach is horrible. Like, if it was indeed him getting to the island, he not only takes in the knife, he doesn't only dig in the knife, he gets inside the carcass of Desmond, swirls it around like a freaking candy cone or cotton candy machine, and pulls out his innards to leave him a complete empty husk. He vivisects that and empties this man so much that it is only going to inform every decision he's going to make for the next 5 years. Like, I guess you could say, if that's the plan, that he's doing this extremely complicated, unnecessarily 5-year plan, sure, good on you.
It's straight out of the other's playbook. That's like how Ben wants to approach Jack. It's like how he approaches Juliet.
Right, but
like,
we talk about want, but want is not successful. There are so many ways this plan could get shot to sunshine that I would not believe that this is an actual thing that is carefully orchestrated by this guy.
I think it's a possibility. I think you could read it as that. I think you could read it as Widmore knowing that there's more to Desmond than meets the eye to bring it back to Beast Wars and Transformers. I think that it's not impossible. I think it's something that could be interpreted. It could be interpreted. Well, either way, Desmond's really only going to interpret it the one way. It was like, wow, that guy is a raging a-hole. Oh my God. He's going to be so mad that he, like Andy Samberg, will throw the tie on the ground.
You're
man.
Not my dad.
Take that, dad.
You don't own me, hot dog man. There's something interesting mentioned in the interview, by the way, about Desmond dropping out of university to look after his three brothers.
Oh, yeah.
Do we get a mention of it? Do you think those are brothers, or do you think that those are like three friends that Desmond calls brother?
Yes. Yeah, my three brothers. You could be one of them too. You could be
now
the fourth
you're my
brother.
Fourth.
Yeah, could be. I would love to meet Desmond's brothers, maybe in Lost too.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised. Maybe it's because we don't get too much like Desmond flashback content. I'm surprised we wouldn't have seen or heard more of them.
Desmond's got a pretty rich world, you know. Like, I think the world surrounding Desmond is untapped. We haven't even talked about Donovan yet. You know, Donovan's hanging out there, so there's a bunch
of
people.
He's one of the brothers.
I hope so. I love Donovan. Donovan's a great guy. It's sad that we only get him the one time.
I mean, he is sort of like substitute Daniel Faraday, considering the role that Faraday plays in the concept, but I think he serves a good role here.
I like him. I think he's good. So Desmond is mad. He leaves, and then another huge moment of deja vu to the tune of Oasis.
I know you.
Sign.
Claire. How do I know you?
Thank you. You can leave your number if you want.
How do I know you?
I don't.
Where do I know you from?
Look, I don't know, but I remember if I could get some help.
Hey, can you get some help?
You're Charlie.
Yeah, name's on the sign.
It was in the hatch. I remember seeing you. There was a computer. There was a button. We were on an island.
We are on an island, mate. This is England.
No, it was real, man. I remember.
Hey, all right. It's just, this is why we don't do drugs.
No, this, I remember this. This all happened before. Today, this happened today. I remember that you said I wasn't worthy, and then I came down and I took off my tie, and then I lost my tie, and Penny said, where was it? And then it started to rain, and...
If the lyrics weren't so fantastically fitting, I would say, of course, Charlie is that guy who said, anyway, here's Wonderwall, while he's busking for people outside Widmore's office.
He kind of like botches the song a little bit. That's
I don't know why he repeated maybe in there.
It's an editing thing.
Maybe he just waited. He's like vamping like, crap, what are the next words?
He's like, oh crap, I don't remember
so
the song.
Where does this fall in the drive shaft timeline? Because this is 1996. Do we assume, because I had always assumed, I don't know why, that like drive shaft was like a late 90s hit band that fell apart. Is this like right before they break big?
I would expect so, because otherwise I think people would probably be losing it more for a 1996 Charlie Pace.
And I would also say that I think when Desmond says, you know, I know you, you would assume that Charlie would respond in that season one Charlie Pace way.
Because I'm
like,
from Drive Shaft.
Yeah, like, oh
blah,
yeah,
blah, blah.
You
yeah.
all everybody, you probably heard it.
Exactly.
And, or the popular commercial.
Exactly. And so the fact that he... again, so like in this world where you're viewing the events of flashes before your eyes as whatever happened, happened, that this stuff happened too, that Charlie and Desmond met before they both came to the island, and that's how it's always been. I think it fits totally fine within like the Desmond stuff, that like he's gonna lose the memories of this, he's like gonna hit his head super hard, he's gonna forget a lot of this stuff. And for Charlie, he's going to go through several years of not being in his right mind. Mm-hmm. So I think for him to have like completely forgotten any of this having ever happened is, speaking from experience, well within the purview of somebody who spends most of their time inebriated. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that that's not a stretch at all. So I think that this idea that Charlie and Desmond met before the island, having always been a thing that happened, that isn't just unique to Desmond right now being in like some like alternate universe or changing things. I think it still fits. I think that like you could still read it that
or
way.
Or Charlie's just face blind. That could be it as well, where he just assumes everyone is Desmond. I believe this is also the episode where Charlie's middle name is introduced.
Hieronymus?
Yeah, I believe so, which obviously is a reference to Hieronymus Bosch, which is a famous painter. We could probably do a deep dive into him, and maybe there could even be like a separate thing. Maybe we'll bring on the guy who plays Thomas for the Art of Lost bonus podcast. But I will say,
it's funny because when you put Charlie and the Man in Black together, their portmanteau is Hieronymus Bosch.
Oh, that makes so much more. That makes so much sense now. And we are, of course, shipping them over the years. And yeah. I also say, good on Charlie for changing his stage name, because I think Charlie Hieronymus Bosch does not exactly ring. It's not very melodic for a musician, especially.
No, I don't think so. But Desmond is starting to wonder, like, okay, maybe this isn't deja vu. Maybe I'm a time traveler. Maybe I'm traveling through time. This is all too weird. I remember this stuff. And he's going to go and meet up with his buddy Donovan, the physicist. And Donovan is going to think that Desmond's a loon. Like, they go out, they start drinking beers. He thinks that all of this is crazy.
I think Donovan's just basically saying, like, this is all, like, a created, like, fictional reality because, like, he just doesn't, you know. He feels like he's maybe
unworthy.
Yeah, like just too stressed out about the penny of it all. It's also a fun little meta moment, because I feel like the way Donovan is speaking about everything is sort of like a representation of those of us that tried to convince people to start watching Lost after season two of like, okay, so there was this machine and it was supposed to save the world. You have to press a button every 108 minutes, and they say you're staring with like the same gawk-eyed expression that Donovan does here.
I think the other thing too, this question of like, why don't we ever see Donovan again, is because like Desmond will get irrefutable proof as the show goes on that he is indeed a time traveler.
Yeah. And also like,
he should
Daniel
probably
Faraday,
go and talk to Daniel Faraday.
I was saying, like, Faraday
is
much more likely to play ball. Desmond threw the ball to Donovan, and Donovan promptly like spiked the ball down and it deflated.
Exactly. It's like, all right, I gave my buddy a shot, but I found somebody who's a little bit better on this topic. But he starts hearing the Mama Cass music, and he starts remembering the soccer game and Jimmy Lennon cricket bat. Jimmy Lennon, that's my favorite, when he's wrong and Jimmy Lennon doesn't come in. He goes, no, they came back though, they won. Jimmy Lennon.
Cricket bat. Do we think, is Jimmy Lennon like a patron and that's why he knows him? Or did Jimmy Lennon be like, oi, I'm Jimmy Lennon and I got a problem with you? Did he like introduce himself? So
yeah,
his
Jimmy Lennon is like, I think, a notorious piece of shit. And so like, he just like pops in and out of this place and just goes around threatening people with the official Jimmy Lennon cricket bat.
Oh, he goes, yeah, he doesn't go anywhere without his beloved cricket bat.
God, I just love that line. Jimmy Lennon.
Yeah, just like
bat.
His fading hope. And Henry and Cusack, again, is so good in this particular state of freaking out. Like, ever since the epiphany scene that we just played, and here of him just being like, I'm so sure about this, but now he's going back on his own work. It's like, wait a minute, am I going crazy? Why isn't this happening right now?
Right.
And it's interesting because, you know, Make Your Own Kind of Music plays, which obviously links back to the hatch of it all, but also, again, going to the theming of the song, he's going to find out very soon that he technically isn't allowed to make his own kind of music. He's supposed to play one particular song and have one particular ending.
So Donovan is like, stop being a jerk, go marry Penny. And so Desmond goes back to his flat, and Penelope's asleep, and he tells her, yeah, so the job interview didn't go great. And Penny's like, good, that dude sucks, I told you. It's great that you're not going to have to work for him. You're a good man. You're rich in goodness. Good men are hard to come by. And Desmond has once again that far off look. She says, "Where are you?" And he goes, "I'm right here. I'm right here, Penn."
Yeah, I also like Penny's, "The occasion is I love you."
Mm-hmm.
While they're going out for lobsters on the pier.
There's a lot about Penny in this episode that's just magnificent. Like the way that Sonia Wilger says the word voila. Mm-hmm. I love that. She's just, Penny's the best. Penny's incredible.
Yeah, which is what makes the heartbreak so heartbreaking. for lack of a better term, is like, she is such a good person in this episode. Again, if you're talking about like faultless characters, you really don't see anything from Penny in this episode that pushes Desmond away from her, which is why, you know, things get so tough for the two of them and why they have been torn apart just by circumstance.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go and introduce another major character to the Lost canon. Desmond, now encouraged by Donovan to propose to Penny, is going to go ring shopping and he's going to encounter somebody who is going to, you know, try and sell him a shitty ring and then not be so thrilled when he wants it. So let's listen in on the first appearance of Eloise Hawking.
Never done this before, have you?
Isn't that obvious?
I can always tell the first timers. Now then, may I ask your price range?
I'm not a man of means. I hope to, you know, one day.
I have just the thing. This won't blind any queens, to be sure, but still has the sparkle of life.
I'll take it.
I'm sorry?
It's perfect. I'll take it.
No, you won't. Give me the ring. Give it here.
Understand.
This is wrong. You don't buy the ring. You have second thoughts. You walk right out that door. So come on, let's have it.
I don't know what you're on about.
You don't buy the ring, Desmond.
How do you know my name?
Well, I know your name as well as I know that you don't ask Penny to marry you. In fact, you break her heart. Well, breaking her heart, of course, is what drives you in a few short years from now to enter that sailing race to prove her father wrong, which brings you to the island where you spend the next 3 years of your life entering numbers into the computer until you are forced to turn that fail-safe key. And if you don't do those things, Desmond David Hume, every single one of us is dead. So give me that sodding ring.
But you said no backsies.
No takesies backsies.
No takesy backsies.
All right, here's my take. I think Eloise Hawking is a criminally underrated character in the history of Lost. I think maybe it's just the shirking off of all the time travel stuff. But
don't threaten me with a good time by putting Eloise Hawking and Shirk together.
Yeah, exactly. But I think Finola Flanagan is just such a fantastic casting. And honestly, I think what Lost needed that was missing was like a dowdy, sassy old British woman. And we finally get an Eloise Hawking. Give me that sodding ring. Is such a fantastic...
It's a good line.
It's such a fantastic line. We're going to talk about this because, spoiler alert, the next clip we're going to play is the further conversations after the break.
Yes. Do you like chestnuts, right? You're just going to play that line.
Yeah, just that over and over again for 2 minutes straight.
Do you like chestnuts? What an odd non-sequitur.
But I love the stuff like her saying, you know, I can always tell the first timers. Clearly, that has a lot of weight to it. You know, if you're talking about connections to season six... When we talk about the ring with the sparkle of light, part of me wondered, is that a call to the possible heart of the island and the ring of life that Desmond is going to help, you know, really save the island and the world later on?
Yep, for sure. I could totally see that.
But I love Eloise has fantastic facial reactions. particularly with the reaction aspect to everything. And as all the WTF-ness is going on with Desmond freaking out, Eloise just gives such a matter-of-fact smile, like, yep, this is your reality, bitch, and you're living in it. Give me the ring back. And it's so well done. It's so, like, sobering, yet so smiley, almost like in a Dolores Umbridge way, that I love it so much.
We've had, you know, there's a lot of questions about Eloise Hawking. Eric Divestein wrote in and said, how does Eloise know so much about Desmond's future? When did she become clairvoyant? Both the great Brendan Fitzpatrick and the great Zach Brooks asked, does she know that Desmond is Daniel's constant? Does she know that there's also a mouse called Eloise? Like, what are the things that she knows? Is she good? Is she bad? Stefan Johnson asks, Eloise Hawking is a villain. She has been since this episode, and she will be until the last episode. The only character with a longer villain streak is the monster. And Dallin Servo adds, does Eloise Hawking own this pawn shop, or was she just using it that day to talk to Desmond? There's so many different questions about Eloise, her intentions, her moral alignment. How much does she know? Does she have superpowers? I think if you can, if whatever you come up with that fits within the rest of the language of the show is totally fine by me. The way that I read Eloise is she kills her son. She deeply mourns it and regrets it, but also dedicates her life to like the preservation of that act, probably after some attempt at trying to figure out, can things be changed, and finding out they can't be. So I think for me, rather than it being like a level of clairvoyance that Eloise Hawking possesses, it makes more sense to me that she's the leader of the others for a time. She kills her son. She goes to investigate what is the veracity of that act? Is that something that actually happened? Ben Linus, as the leader of the others, knows about the frozen donkey wheel. Like, time travel as like the leader of the others feels like a thing that you could possibly resort to
It's in the binder, the orientation manual.
It's in exactly so, yeah. Like they have that under the hood as a possibility. And I think that the possibility of her like scanning possible futures, hopping around, going around and looking at this stuff, finding out about Desmond and finding out about like the ways in which all of this stuff fits together. That makes more sense to me for the character of Eloise than she has like some sort of like weird, like I see the future type of power, more that she is using a power that is available within the language of Lost. But yeah, is she a villain? I think that you could certainly read it that way. I think it's also like she's complicated. She's a very complicated person. She does a very terrible thing. But if her rationale is to get Desmond to the island so he can push the button and so that he can more specifically turn the failsafe key when John Locke destroys the button, then she really is looking out for everybody in that moment.
So two things. First, I do believe, you know, she gets Daniel the journal when he's a kid, because I believe, I don't know if he shows her the journal outright, maybe she goes through his stuff after she accidentally kills him, and I can imagine that Faraday wrote up a good amount about Desmond after he visited him during the events of the Constant, so I would think it's in the realm of possibility that Eloise knows a lot about the timeline of Desmond in particular, considering how important he is. As to her larger role, I'm sorry to keep going back to the Arrowverse, but it's at top of mind. I just finished season one of Legends of Tomorrow. Eloise Hawking is a time master, and not that she is a time traveler, but she is someone who not only, to your point, knows about the concept of time travel, but has sort of like become the main source of it, in a manner of speaking, to the point where she is going to be the one to speak about it to Desmond. And to that point, she is also sort of like the relegator of the timeline, who wants to make sure that the trains run on time and that those major events, those macro events in the timeline, are continuously hit so things don't spin out of control. So I do think maybe due to a combination of intel that she had and just the general role that she plays, I agree. It's actually, ironically enough, less interesting to me if she has a power. I think it's more so someone who is like haunted by their past and is purposely
she's doing the work, putting in that like that sweat equity to see if she can't fix it. She can't fix it.
Yeah. And that caused her, I think, to also become obsessed with this idea of like maintaining a timeline, right? Like she learned that whatever happened. So she has to make sure that things do not go haywire. And so she's the one to sort of represent that in that regard, no matter who she's actually working with at this point. And I think that's what makes her so interesting in approaching Desmond here, because this is someone that she does not know. He does not know from Adam. And she just comes here very saying, I know your middle name. I know what you're going to do. give me back the ring. Do you like chestnuts? In that order.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, totally agreed. All right. Let's keep the scene going. They go and get chestnuts, and then more wacky time travel-y, timey-wimey stuff, as Ben Martell likes to call it, occurs.
That man over there is wearing red shoes.
So, what then?
Just thought it was a bold fashion choice worth noting.
This isn't really happening, is it?
Sorry?
I've had a concussion. You're my subconscious.
Am I?
You're here to talk me out of marrying Penny. Well, it won't bloody work.
Oh, yes, it will.
No. There is no island. There is no button. It's madness. I love her. She loves me. I'm going to spend the rest of my life with her.
No, Desmond. You're not.
Oh, my God. You knew that was going to happen, didn't you? Then why didn't you stop it? Why didn't you do anything?
Because it wouldn't matter. Had I warned him about the scaffolding, tomorrow he'd be hit by a taxi. If I warned him about the taxi, he'd fall in the shower and break his neck. The universe, unfortunately, has a way of course-correcting. That man was supposed to die. That was his path. Just as it's your path to go to the island. You don't do it because you choose to, Desmond. You do it because you're supposed to.
I'm going to meet Penny in an hour. Under the ring. She'll say yes. I can choose whatever I want.
You may not like your path, Desmond, but pushing that button is the only truly great thing that you will ever do.
And that's a lie.
Nah, he'll do other great stuff.
Yeah.
He's gonna, you know, he's gonna take a hit to the head with a cricket bat pretty much like a champion. That's pretty great.
He's gonna, you know, help save Claire's life, because I'm assuming if Charlie died drowning saving Claire, you would assume that she would have died as well.
You'd think so too. Yeah. He's gonna sustain drinking a bottle of McCutcheon for 5 seconds without batting an eye, so you gotta assume that it probably goes on longer and the show's doing us the mercy of cutting away.
He's going to have a son. He's gonna like pass on his lineage as well. Desmond's gonna go on to do a lot of great things. I guess in terms of like magnanimity, he does save the world in that regard, so this is maybe the greatest thing he'll do in terms of size. But like Eloise, and I guess this is a bit of manipulation, right? But like, don't whitewash Desmond's future accolades here with one great thing.
He's gonna wear killer scarves.
Yeah,
you know his fashion game is gonna be great.
He's gonna have a kick-ass haircut too when he joins the royal army. But yeah, this is such, again, it's done so well with Eloise Hawking being just so like, it almost sounds like she's narrating like an audiobook with her just being so like, well, this is what time is, like you're stuck with your path, and you know, if that man with the red shoes, if I told him about the scaffolding, he would have gotten hit by a taxi, like he was doomed to die no matter what. Such dark material, but said in such a great way. Even like when Desmond says, you know, that this guy died, she gives this nod to be like, oh, what a shame. Oh, isn't that the pits? As if like it started raining instead of this man getting basically crushed to death by scaffolding on top of him.
Such an odd line. That man over there is wearing red
shoes. It sounds a bit like she's like, I don't know, a little, you know, she's a little up in years, so maybe things are fading a bit of like, that man has red shoes.
Red shoes. Yeah. So that dude's not going to make it. LVP point to the man in the red shoes for dying.
He looked pretty fetching, though. I will say he made the Converse
match
well with the fedora and the suit.
But he died. He did die. So I'll just give him an LVP point this week.
I
think like one of the things, because of like the really kind of like neat time travel rules to the show of whatever happened, makes some of like the wonkiness to that really stand out. And one of the big examples is like the paradox of the John Locke compass that Richard Alpert gives to him because John Locke tells him to give it, but it's actually the smoke monster telling him to do it. Like that whole thing, like where did the compass originate? How did the compass like start? I think is a question. And I think like to some extent, the Faraday journal falls into that realm.
Right.
Like as you're trying to like really think about how does Eloise know all the things that she knows? I think, you know, like how does she know about Desmond? How does she know what he's about to do? How does Faraday know about Desmond? How does Faraday know to put in his notebook if anything goes wrong, Desmond Hume is my constant? Because Eloise read Faraday's notebook and like drills this into Faraday at some point. You know what I mean? Like there are ways in which this all just circles the drain. And I think that that's a really fun aspect of the time travel stuff for me. I love a paradox. I think paradoxes are great. I think for some people, they can be really unsatisfying and confusing in storytelling. And I derive a lot of pleasure and satisfaction from sort of like less, I would describe it less as confusion and more as, you know, feeling dizzy by something, you know, feeling scrambled by something. So I think that that's all here with the Desmond and Eloise relationship. And I really quite like it, Mike. I like it quite a bit. And I really like this character. And I love the performance that she's giving here. And I think mythologically, Eloise Hawking is such a fascinating person, but I would stick to like my read of this episode is that like the reason why Desmond's going to go on and break up with Penny is in no small part thanks to this conversation he's about to have with Eloise Hawking.
It's completely because of that. Like he's going
and that is how it always went down. That this always was a piece of it.
I mean,
this was all.
It helps that he doesn't see her again in this timeline until after he gets off the island. Too. So it's not like he's going to, like Charlie, have like a run-in on the island that you could sort of chalk up to forgetfulness. He's never going to see this woman again, which is also why it's so great too, right? Because if it was like Charles Winmore having this conversation, that would have a different weight to it. But because he's in his life, I feel like it has less meaning than like, ironically enough, than this random-ass woman just showing him. I remember the perception at the time was like, who the hell is this? Because Eloise is also not going to show up again for a
long time.
And I do think that was a bit of like a strike against the episode at the time. Is like, why are they introducing this person? But I do think in hindsight, it really reverberates so well that they introduced this character so early.
It.
Yeah.
I love it.
Considering the roles that she's going to play with this theming in general.
Yeah, and like, you know, the things that he's going to say to Penny in a minute here about why he's breaking up with her. Like he's going to get hit in the head with the cricket bat. He's going to bounce back forward in time. Desmond will wake up from being knocked unconscious and probably just remember all the things that he said to Penny or be reminded of the things that he said to Penny when Penny like is like, yeah, don't come back here. You were just such a super dick to me. He didn't say anything about Eloise Hawking. He didn't say anything about the time travel stuff with her. So I think that that all still folds into itself fairly neatly. But after this interaction, he's gonna keep the ring. Seems like he doesn't have to pay for it. That's nice.
Which makes it feel like it wasn't her shop. If she just took this, if she tied up the owner and just like
gave
stuff away
for free. Exactly. I mean, I think again, like very others level tactics that are in play from both Charles Widmore and Eloise Hawking this week potentially. Like that is such a move. It's like, yeah, I'm the ring shop owner for sure. For sure. Ring shop owner isn't dead in the closet. No way. I would expect that person is deceased.
But we see what's going to lead into the flashback events of Live Together, Die Alone, where Desmond walks by a poster and it says right there everything he needs. Honor, adventure, and become a man you can be proud of.
Yep.
And watching Honor, no matter how it's spelled, really reminded me, Josh, so when Desmond tells Penny that he's going on the trip to get his honor back, I don't know. It's interesting watching these events and comparing it to that, because I feel like we're led to believe in this portion that, you know, Desmond never had honor to begin with. That's what, like, Charles Widmore is essentially telling him and dressing him down. So to have him say that he is getting it back made him feel like he once had honor and he is now reclaiming it, as opposed to just, I need to get honor in general so I can, you know, endear myself in front of your father.
Yeah. I don't know where his honor was before all this, but he just seems to have a pretty low opinion of his honor. One assumes also his Jervis. He's not too fond of.
I've got to get my Jervis back.
I need to get my Jervis back, Penny. Desmond's going to meet Penny. It's time for the picture. A nice picture to show the grandkids. All those grandkids.
What does Penny have against the Alps?
I don't get it. She's like, oh, I hate the Alps.
What do they
really
do to you?
That is, I mean, like, that is like the bougiest thing. Penny Widmore really showing her status. I go to the Alps every year. It's old habit.
Well, maybe she took a trip with Chucky Witt and he like did something real dickish to her then, and that's like why she's really forsworn him.
Maybe. But no, the marina, that's where it's at.
Oh, yeah.
Show
give me
the marina.
Those static boats instead of stupid mountains any day of the week.
Yeah, that's right in Honolulu. Very easy to go and find that. It's part of the cost tours that they do out there in Hawaii, should people ever be able to travel again. It's something that they do there. So really, really fun to see that come to life here. They take the picture. I love that Penny is like, take the jacket off. We're looking at palm trees here. It's supposed to be hot. I like that she's just like critiquing for the details.
We're not in the bloody Alps.
They take the picture. It's an instant classic. And for Desmond, it is instantly a sign of what it is he's got to do.
Oh boy, here we go.
I couldn't go through with that.
What was that?
I can't do this.
You can't do what?
Us. This. This relationship.
What are you talking about?
How can I? I can't look after you. I haven't got a job. I don't have any. I can't even afford £5 for a bloody photograph. You deserve someone better.
I know what I deserve. I chose to be with you. I love you.
Love's not enough. Being a good man is not enough.
What's this about, Des? Where's this coming from?
It's all happening too soon. You moving in, you painting rooms, you changing things. I don't even like red. And why would you leave your flat, your expensive flat?
Don't do that. Don't you pretend you don't care. And don't you dare rewrite history. I left my expensive flat because you were too proud to live there, remember? If you want me to go, if you want me to leave, then don't make this about what I do or don't deserve. And have the decency to admit that you're doing this because you're a coward.
Sorry, Ben, but this... We're not supposed to be together.
I believe Bill
CGI ring.
Yeah, Bill Paxton's going to find that ring underwater a few years from now.
Too soon. Hold on a second, Mike. Emily, can you hear me? What is the name of Bill Paxton's character from Titanic? Brock Lovett? My wife loves Brock Lovett.
Oh, but she loved Brock Lovett.
Yeah, she loves Brock Lovett. So add Brock Lovett to like the American Desmond Hume.
Brock Lovett from Titanic.
Man, imagine Bill Paxton as Desmond would have been great.
That would have been. I mean, he's into Big Love, and Desmond has a lot of love as well.
Yeah. R.I.P. One of the greats. One of the all-time greats.
I love that the photograph in particular is the thing that sort of like triggers this in Desmond, because I think it's the symbolism of a photograph, that it is a literal snapshot, and that it is sort of like a permanence of an image, unless you're in the Harry Potter universe where things are moving around. Like, this is a freeze frame of this particular moment in time. And I can imagine not only is this associative to him, this is also a reminder of what Eloise just said, right? In spite of the slight changes, this photo still exists in the future. And it shows that, yeah, whatever happened is going to happen. And so you need to push yourself towards doing these things, and you're going to have to go through this very sudden and very heartbreaking breakup.
Yeah. He's going to say in the next scene, right, when he goes to drink the cheapest pint they've got, that he's made the biggest mistake of his life, and he's pretty sure he's made it again. So that, to me, underscores the motivation here, right? Yeah. That, like, he has taken Eloise Hawking's words to heart, and he's like, I have to break up with her because these memories of the future I'm having are indeed memories of the future, and I have to go and take care of that. And so I have to push Penny away here now, and I have to satisfy the fate. So that all tracks. It's very sad.
Oh yeah,
I don't like to see Penny and Desmond fighting.
No, we're not supposed to be together line is just gutting.
Oh, it's gutting
because you know he doesn't believe it, but like he knows he has to say it. We get a little bit of even fleshing out their past. Maybe the honor question comes from the fact that apparently Desmond was too proud to live in Penny's flat. He basically was like, "No, you're moving in with me because we shouldn't live in a place that's like backed by dirty Widmore money."
This is the Jack stuff, though. Too proud. Like, come on, go live in the cool flat. You know, Penny. If Penny doesn't have a problem with it, go live in the cool flat. But this is a you
but
thing.
But Penny, you could just feel like the world drop out from under her, and she's like begging, being like every argument that he provides, she's like, has a counterpoint to it. And of course, I think what really stings without even realizing it is when she says, "Don't you dare rewrite history," because he's tried and he realizes that he can't, and that's why he's doing this. It's just such a great conversation in one of the like most, I don't know, in one of the most just devastating ways, but it's an eventuality, and I think it's acted and written so beautifully.
And I think one of the things, if like you're tracking the Penny arc, is so this happens with Penny and Des. They break up here. At some point, not terribly long after this, Desmond is going to, you know, run away from the Royal Scots and find Penny again and say, call this number in like however many years, I forget off the top of my head. And like she's going to go ahead and do that. Like she is going to hear from Desmond that he believes in, like, you know, like, I'm going to need you in a few years down the line. If you love me at all, you'll remember. She's still going to track him down to Los Angeles before he goes on the race around the world. And then he's going to disappear, and she's going to devote all these resources to finding Desmond and finding the island. So I like to believe that eventually they have a conversation about like all of this stuff. It's like, yeah, I was time traveling when I broke up with you.
And she's like,
I totally get it.
Yeah,
I get
and because
it
she's
I
Penny,
totally
she
do.
Totally nods, is like, I absolutely understand. Like, does not bat an eyelash at that whole entire proposition and says, look, we're dealing with so much crazy stuff. Did you hear about what my father has done?
Yeah, like, my dad was another. It was crazy.
Yeah, exactly. You know? So, like, it's fine. I understand. Come back to bed. Let's have lobsters at the pier. I'm buying.
Yeah. So, just fun to think about the reconciliation between those characters. Desmond goes to the pub. He had the wrong night. The music's back. It's the game. Also, should note, this came our way from the great Jim Fells, that there's lots of Easter eggs in the soccer match, that there's all these advertisements for Lost brands that are shown during the game, including one for Apollo Bars, Oceanic, the Hanzo Foundation. There's even an expose,
which is weird because the show doesn't exist at this point.
Yeah. You know, well, they must have known that they were going towards it. Mr. Klux is
unless,
in there.
Maybe there was
as
a
well.
Show that previously existed called Expose, sort of like, the predecessor of this show was an NBC show called Lost that was sort of themed after The Amazing Race. There just happens to be another show called Expose. Also in the bar, Desmond takes a look at the McCutcheon and instead goes for, quote-unquote, the cheapest, which I think is like a show of that self-flagellation, right? Of like, I don't deserve, you know, the expensive stuff. Even though I'm going to be a great man and save the world, like, I'm no good.
Yeah, so he's going to notice all this. He's like, all right, I can change it. I can change everything. I'll be able to change everything. It's going to work. It's going to, like, I'm not crazy. I can still make this right. And then Jimmy Lemon comes in with his stupid freaking cricket bat. And Desmond thinks that he can change things starting here. But my read on it would be that Desmond's memory of Jimmy coming in with the cricket bat and knocking out the bartender is obscured by the fact that he's the one who got knocked out.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, that's right. Like, he goes in charging after the bartender, but Desmond's the one who takes the
brunt. Or do you think maybe this bartender is a real, like, MVP? He wakes Desmond up, he's like, oh my goodness, that guy came in and beat me up because he knew that Desmond would be so embarrassed to get hit by Jimmy Lennon's cricket bat.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, he came in and, like, really, you know, clobbered me. And so that's just stuck in Desmond's head the entire time, this wrong information.
It's possible, but I think, like, you can imagine that he has flashes of how this all played out.
So what soccer team plays 2 days in a row? The exact same team.
Mike, we're about to get added over that for sure.
I opened up that Pandora's box.
Yep,
I want to go back. I want to go back.
Yeah, change it.
Please
change
let
it.
Me no, go back.
We won't change it. So he gets knocked out. He wakes up in the jungle. He's naked. Hatch is gone. Finds the photo. I want to change it. I'll do it again. Let me go back.
Again, like, that gives me so many feels. Like, he's just begging because he's like, I know I can make things right this time. Like, I had Penny in my grasp after I thought I lost her for 3 years and I almost killed myself for her. I got to see her again. I know I can go back and do things. And he's just, like, begging, not begging in the way that, like, John Locke has done in the past, in the, you know, what do you want me to do way, ironically, where Desmond meets John Locke in a manner of speaking, but more so just, like, crying out to whatever powers that be had him flash in the first time of, like, please let me do this again. It's almost like the opposite of Scrooge. Actually, it is Scrooge. Take me back, oh spirits.
Yeah, but he's stuck in this loop. This happens. This has to happen. This is constantly happening. This is something that is a fixture in Desmond's life and a huge part of why he's here. And I think that's a great part of the tragedy of the character is, he's somebody who thinks he's not an honorable dude, and he is somebody who is constantly choosing, a greater good than his own personal enjoyment. This is something that he's going to do a few times throughout the series. He's very much a heroic character. So when Charlie has called him a coward, it's understandably triggering, which is why he's beating the snot out of Charlie as we come back to that.
But I will say we get a pretty awkward, not on the level of like the end of the 48 days, but actually like verging kind of close where like, I find this a bit unnecessary that we have to then do the montage of all the Desmond flashes of the lightning rod and everything, just because I feel like you either put that in the previously on or you put that here. Don't do both. I feel like if they had just cut directly from that to Desmond choking Charlie, it would have been fine.
Doesn't bother me that much, but I totally get it. I think like at this point though, like now they're confirming that like, he's very special on all of this. Wasn't just some weird fever dream. This was all something that happened to Desmond, that he is, you know, he's unstuck in time to a certain degree.
Yeah, and so his violence immediately turns heartbreaking when we flash to the present, where Desmond then just starts breaking down, taking his hands off of Charlie's neck and just muttering, you can't change it. And it's clear he is just so morose at this point because he feels utterly hopeless with the path that he has been given. As Eloise said, you might not like it, but you have to take it.
All right, so let's finish up the episode because this is about things you can't change. And one of the things I love about this episode is it's such an emotional mind F, but it ends with a really scary cliffhanger. Certainly at the time, we were like, oh, what? So let's play that whole scenario out to close this out.
You're a good man, Tony. So I'm sorry I tried to strangle you, all right? Oh,
can't believe me. Here we go. Sorry I called you a coward.
Well, you're all right, pal.
Desmond. You are going to tell me what happened to you.
Well, that's on that key. My life flashed before my eyes. And then I was back in the jungle.
Still on this bloody island? But those flashes, Charlie. Those flashes, they didn't stop.
So, you tell me you saw a flash of Claire drowning this morning. That's how you knew how to save her.
I wasn't saving Claire, Charlie. I was saving you. This morning, you dove in after Claire. You tried to save her, but you drowned.
What are you talking about? I didn't drown.
When I saw the lightning hit the roof, you were electrocuted. And when you heard Claire was in the water, you drowned trying to save her. I dove in myself, so you never went in. I've tried, brother. I've tried twice to save you, but the universe has a way of course correcting, and I can't stop it forever. I'm sorry because no matter what I try to do, you're gonna die, Charlie.
Yeah, wild. That's wild. Okay. Iconic line, you're gonna die, Charlie.
And so I mentioned this previously on the last episode, but people who didn't follow Lost at the time, so this season we were told, you know, a major character is going to die. And we're not just talking like the tailies of it all. And outside of that, that really hadn't happened since, you know, Shannon, I guess to a lesser extent, but really Boone, I think, was the last time we had like a really weighty, impactful death. No offense to Shannon. And so I know I was thinking at the time, due to all the stuff that Desmond was doing and the way he was sort of talking, I thought it was going to be Claire, right? Because it was Claire whose shelter was being protected by the lightning. It was Claire who was saved from drowning. And so it's almost like a swerve to know that Desmond's trying to save a character from dying. And then another swerve on top of that when you find out it wasn't Claire, it's Charlie. And Charlie Pace has officially been given the black spot.
Yeah, he's been marked. And so it's like we're now at this point where we'll get to it, you know, many weeks from now, not a terribly long time from now, but some weeks from now, that we are in the final act of one Charlie Pace, and probably, even though it's, you know, horrible for the character, it's also sort of like the best thing that could have happened to the character.
Yeah, well, especially, I mean, just look at the behavior from this episode, where even when Charlie brings Desmond back to his shelter, he's still like, yeah, you know, it's okay that you choked me, like I was being kind of an asshole, but also you're going to tell me what happened. Like, he's still playing hardball with him, and Desmond gives it to him straight, or as straight as he can, and Desmond is so guilt-ridden here, specifically that line, I can't stop it forever. Like, now you can imagine just the mental algebra that he's been doing this entire time, where he essentially has not only been like doing his stuff, but also now having to like babysit Charlie to essentially make sure he doesn't walk over a cliff or like eat the wrong berries or something. He's been trying to delay the inevitable, and it clearly has been weighing on him, which is why he wails on Charlie so much when the guy he's trying to protect calls him a coward.
The ending of this episode is just so exciting. It's dreadful. I think, you know, so we had multiple people ask us the question of which episode is better, Flashes Before Your Eyes or The Constant. And I think the popular conventional wisdom is The Constant. You know, The Constant is the episode that is often cited as the best episode of Lost. I don't really know that there's much we can do to settle that one way or the other.
not until we've seen The Constant, I think.
Yeah, and even when we do, we're going to have been so removed from Flashes Before Your Eyes at that point that, you know, it'll be hard to say. They're both going to get perfect scores from both of us. Mm-hmm. I think that's pretty clear. I would say, even though I love the ending of The Constant of going to Faraday's notebook, and if anything goes wrong, Desmond will be my constant, is a really like spooky final note to end on. No matter what I do, Charlie, you're going to die, has such a a dangerous quality to it and a sense of urgency behind it, because everything else that you've just seen from the events surrounding Desmond in this episode strongly suggest that, yeah, the rules dictate that Charlie Pace is probably going to die. So there's just like, there is this, the constant is very likely the better episode of Lost. I would say the constant is the better episode of Lost.
I think the constant essentially takes a lot of the emotionality and cool stuff that's contained in Flash of Four Eyes and combines like the action element with the freighter of it all, and this also new aspect of flashing back and forth.
Yes. But I think that the ending of Flashes Before Your Eyes is, I would say, like, if the constant ended with the Desmond and Penny phone call, that would be the better ending for sure. But there is another scene that happens after that. It's the Faraday on the beach looking at the notebook.
Yeah, the Desmond Hume is your constant. And I would also say that I think, no matter if it ends with the Penny Desmond conversation anyway, this is by far the more impactful ending, because this has now signed a death warrant impending for a character. Not only that, a character who was one of like the first three people to go on the first ever A-team mission of the show. This is a major, major facet of the show, even if people did not necessarily like him being a part of season two. And this is a huge piece of news. This is not some Tayley or some disliked character like your Nikki and Paolo that is going to go the way of the dodo. This is Charlie Pace, and this is going to be a big deal to the point where, like,
and they're going to do it.
Yeah, this is going to be Charlie's storyline the rest of the season.
It's not an empty threat, you know. The Grim Reaper's coming, and he's got a cricket bat.
he missed the bat in season one when he was hung by Ethan in the tree, but now he does not miss.
Yeah, so really, really great.
And I will say the really quick, the thing that I also love about this is the last shot is on Desmond. We don't go back to Charlie for his reaction. And they definitely could have done like the stunned zoom into Charlie's face as we cut to Lost. But I love that we cut that out, because it just, again, adds to the mystery. Like, it leaves us in the lurch of that moment to be like, it really makes you say, what the hell's going to happen next?
Well, yeah, because, like, there is another element of the horror to this, is that, once again, Desmond is being tasked with this impossible, repetitive task. Except instead of having to push a button every 108 minutes, he's having to save a man's life from grisly future murders every however many, you know, minutes or days he's doing it. So once again, Desmond is back on a job, and I guess the good news is he's not like stuck in, you know, like a bomb shelter or whatever, having to just push a button and hearing the beeping. But this is not fun. You know, he's not making good money doing the Charlie protection thing.
It is a sort of a weird would you rather. I wish I had asked this to Robin and Kiva last week when they had them on. Like, would you rather have the fate of a bunch of people you don't know in your hand, or the fate of like one person you really do know in your hands? Like, does the personal association make it that much harder for Desmond as to like, hey, if you end up not pushing the button, a bunch of people will die, but it's nobody that you really know from like an emotional basis.
Yeah. So, it's a great episode. Again, just to do this a little bit out of order, we could just get the rankings out of the way. It's the best of the season. It's a 4.2 from me, 4.2 from Mike. It's a 4.1 from the audience. That's a very high score. It's a 4.16, and I'll be curious to see how it compares to some of the other episodes this season. I expect it'll obviously be very high, but I think that that's one of these things about season three, Mike, is, yeah, there's some of like these episodes that are sort of, you know, sagging towards the bottom. We're going to get to one next week. We'll get to arguably the worst episode of Lost next week. But there's going to be episodes like The Man from Tallahassee or The Brig or The Man Behind the Curtain. And of course, Through the Looking Glass, but also Greatest Hits. There are some episodes this season that are transcendent. Good. Flashes Before Your Eyes is absolutely one of them, and a very, very comfortable current number one of season three, and very close to, you know, the top spot overall so far, which is pretty wild.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a roller coaster, because we're going to plummet to the bottom with Stranger in a Strange Land. Trisha Tanaka, which is one of those episodes that you and I have talked about many times, but I think is going to score some pretty high marks. Enter 7-7 and Par Avion might like middle out a bit. Then we get Man from Tallahassee, then Expose, which certainly has thoughts. So like, we're definitely in for a couple of other clunkers to middling episodes, but I think Flashes Before Your Eyes, as much as I love, you know, Cost of Living and Tale of Two Cities, this was the first episode, at least in season three, if not, again, as I mentioned, six and since Exodus, where I just sort of like said, wow, in response to the show, because it was something so audaciously done to break so much format right in the middle of their run that they were able to do it so well as well. It was a tightrope act, and they crossed pretty darn seamlessly, you know, save a couple of things. But that being said, it wasn't enough to warrant a 4.1 for me. Just it is a perfect episode of Lost, and what it's able to do and be so unique, even from another episode like The Constant that echoes it in a different way, just sets it apart from the rest.
Let's do MVP LVPs before we close out here. Very easy to give Desmond an MVP point this week.
Yeah, let's double up on Desi here.
All right, so two for Desmond. I'll give one to Eloise Hawking as well.
Yeah, I'll give another one to her. Much like Richard Alpert last week, I think it's we're two for two so far, and like fantastic debuts for big characters.
Really,
in
really
season
great.
Three.
Yeah, and I got to give one to Penny because Penny's just awesome.
Yeah, Penny's great. Like again, she really did nothing wrong in this episode. She just like fell victim to circumstance.
LVP wise, you've got three to hand out.
And two are going to Charles Widmore. Say what you want to about why he's doing it, but he is a dick.
Yep, for sure. And I agree completely. So have to give one to Widmore as well. So he's getting three total this week.
Yeah, which is, you know, starting to put him down that these are going to be his first points in season three. I can't remember how many we gave him during Live Together, Die Alone.
I think just one
okay,
negative.
Okay, so he's slowly, you know, starting down that precipice. It's going to take him a long time to get down to the Anthony Coopers and Pickett.
We've got him
the
on the show, in and out of the show for a very long time. So, you know, I expect he'll plummet.
Yeah, who are you? And Red Shoes dude.
Yeah, he dies. It's been a while since.
You know,
done
if it really was the Wizard of Oz, Eloise would have taken the Red Shoes and given them to Desmond, and Desmond would have gone off skipping down the road.
Yeah, true.
All right, I got added about this specifically, saying don't give Charlie an LVP point because, like Ethan, he's an a-hole, but he gets what he wants. I'm still giving him an LVP point here. He acts like an a-hole in this episode. And look, we're going to get a lot of redemption for Charlie from this point moving forward. But I don't think I want to necessarily use that to discredit the way he was really needling Desmond over the course of this episode before Desmond finally gave him what he wanted.
Yeah, where is Charlie? Is still really languishing, huh?
Well, yeah, Charlie overall. Charlie has only gotten negative points so far because I think we docked him one for further instructions as well for surprise, being kind of an asshole.
Yeah,
so he's definitely still he's falling further into the negatives at this point. I know we talked at some point about like will Charlie get to at least zero, and that prospect's looking thinner and thinner.
It's looking
as the
grim.
Episode.
Looking yeah. grim. That's the tension. We'll see. Desmond is now our third place for season three. Juliet's still in the lead with 8, then Sawyer with 5, and Desmond with 4. And Widmore is now in a two-way second place for LVP with Mr. Paik.
That makes a lot of sense, considering, again, and that's the interesting thing about that Widmore and Desmond scene as well, is because we think we're going down that path, right? Where Widmore's like, yeah, I'm going to bring you into my company in a low-level role, much like Paik did with Jin to sort of keep control over him, and then we take it in a completely different direction. It again shows, like you said before, like how we can take the skeletons of a lot of different character arcs on Lost, but fill them with completely different organs and make completely different bodies out of them.
Next week, Mike, Stranger in a Strange Land, and we've been, it's been requested, can we only give out LVPs next week? Sorry, that's not the game. We got to play within the rules. We've broken enough rules as we've gone along here on Down the Hatch. I think we'll play this one straight. But we're up to the Jack's Tattoos episode, Mike Bloom. It's happening.
Oh boy, here we go. And it's tough because like you're like, well, Jack, finding out the origin of Jack's tattoos, at least we can find solace in what happens on the island. You know, we have some other the sheriff, we have Isabel coming in, Juliet getting branded. There's not a lot of light to look forward to, which sucks. You know, especially at following this episode. I know that you have made the case before as to the necessity of this episode.
The function of the episode.
Right.
As we get closer to it, like the feeling is like, yeah, this will be the lowest rated episode of the rewatch for sure so far.
And probably moving forward as well, because I think the other contender would be Across the Sea, which I think you and I similarly like find utility in.
Well, yeah, and I find utility in this as well, but it doesn't like pay off in an urgent way. And I also think that like we've got a fix for Across the Sea. Like we're gonna watch that one out of order when we get to it. So that might be unfair to the episode. That might be unfair to the experience. Yeah,
there's no place you could put Stranger in a Strange Land except in the trash. That would make sense. But you know, it's gonna have a lot of personal resonance. Because I am sitting here a freshly tattooed man myself. So I find myself connecting with Jack Shepard now more than ever. Of course, my characters are in English, not in Chinese or in Thai. But we're going to get into it all. Tattoos on both real people and fictional next week.
I'm really excited to get into the origin story of Mike Bloom's tattoos next week. Because certainly Rob is a podcast fans. And listeners are well aware of the story behind Mike's tattoos.
Ironically enough, it also involves Biling, I believe.
You know, maybe down the hatch listeners a little bit less. So we'll get into that next week for sure. Stranger in a Strange Land, Mike, coming up next. Down the hatch at postshowrecaps.com with your ratings. We already have a zero.
That's the bar. Don't feel ashamed.
We've got 1-0. I see you, Ben, behind the curtain.
And it's of all people.
So, you know, there's just no escaping it. This is going to be anchoring us at the very bottom. We'll get into it next week. I'm sure we'll have a really fun podcast.
It's going to be a great time. And I think, you know, this conversation also netted a lot of theories and discussions as to how time travel works in this universe. As Josh said before, it really is, your mileage may vary. So we want to hear from you all as to, especially because I don't know if you all, everybody, want to talk about Stranger in a Strange Land. If you prefer to have your email talk about your thoughts on time travel in general and how it exists within the world of Lost, please do, because this is a fun topic. As Josh said before, like, it's convoluted and it's complicated, but it's so much fun to pick brains over this, and I want to continue that brain picking, because time travel is not going to be gone from the show for a long, long time.
Not at all. All right, we'll be back next week, everybody. Jack's tattoos coming up next here on Down the Hatch. Take care. Bye-bye. 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 20, 42, 4, 8,